It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers who track gun violence find the murder rate falling across the country. Milwaukee following suit with a double-digit decline in homicides so far this year, those statistics from the Milwaukee Police Department. But can you say it's a trend, and will it continue? Call in with your question or comments about crime. The number to be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeffrey Fagan is here, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying policing, crime, gun control, and race. Jeffrey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've seen these news reports, criminologists noting this positive trend this year with the murder rate in the U.S. falling by more than 10% so far this year. In Milwaukee, homicide rate is down almost 30% from last year. What is your explanation for this drop?
Well, it's not the first time we've seen a dramatic drop from a recent peak in the homicide rate in the U.S. These things tend to run in cycles. And over the past, I'd say going back to the 1960s, we've seen very distinct cycles of sharp rises and then followed by sharp decreases in the homicide rate. There was an increase in the 1960s through the early 70s, another increase in the late 70s into the early 80s, a sharp decline up through about 1985. Then another spike in the late 80s into the early 90s, which was around the time of the crack epidemic. And then after 1993 or so, the rates just fell and just kept falling and falling across the country, in the cities across the country, and stayed pretty low up into the pandemic. And just at the moment of the pandemic, a little bit before, actually, homicide rates started to spike up, and that was in 2020. And now in 2023, we're seeing the same sharp decline that we saw in 1993 and 1981 and 1972. It's just a cyclical pattern over time.
Do researchers like yourself try to connect the dots on these cyclical patterns and be able to explain them further?
It's really hard to do. There's a lot of variation from one city to the next. This is mostly a city phenomenon. The best explanation that for me, others may disagree with me, is that each one of these things tended to coincide with a public health crisis of one sort or another. So in the 1960s, it was a heroin epidemic, coupled with a lot of social upheaval in the 1960s in the cities around the country. In the 1970s, it was the emergence of cocaine markets in the U.S., and these were primarily at that time street markets, and the street markets were very volatile. But also there were, again, other economic dislocations in the late 1970s from the oil embargoes and unemployment rates and high inflation. And so there's a lot of multiple causes operating. And the crack market was pretty much the same following a stock market crash than the emergence of a street market in crack cocaine, which, again, was even more volatile than the earlier markets. The homicides there rose. And then they collapsed pretty much as the crack epidemic collapsed. If you skip ahead to the pandemic, this is another disease epidemic, but it was of a different sort. But it still had the same social and economic dislocations. And so we see very kind of the repetitive pattern of the context, the enabling factors in cities and the sort of the socio-political environment in the cities, followed by rises and then falls. So, you know, I tend to think of it, and I think others do, as something of a contagious epidemic, like a flu epidemic or any other kind of disease epidemic. And they rise and fall in kind of a cyclical or natural pattern. And at some point, as we say in the contagion field, you run out of susceptibles, and everybody who's going to get involved in violence, or everybody who's going to pick up a crack pipe, or everybody who's going to buy heroin on the street, they all saturate, and then they're gone because there's nobody replacing them. So it's we call it a period or a cohort effect or an epidemic effect, but it's a very, very discernible, measurable process. So most of, there's been a huge homicide decline starting in the late 2022 and into the current months now. And just it's important to keep in mind that somebody in a city may say, well, we're not experiencing that kind of decline. So these things don't happen at the identical same time in each one of the cities. So it's important to bear in mind that this is a trend, but everybody comes sort of phases in at a different point in time. But the broad trend is present. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to just back up a tiny bit here to 2020 and play some sound. There was this forum hosted by Concordia University last month, and Milwaukee's Assistant Police Chief Nicole Waldner cautioned that statistics need to be looked at over time.
We have to look at it in a large increment of time. And the problem is 2020 changed everything. Like 2020 can't even be considered because nothing was normal, right? And so now we have this 2020 in the middle of these statistics that's messing up everything else.
Messing up everything else. How clear of a picture do analysts have of what's happening? And then how do you deal with 2020 and the COVID pandemic?
I think if we look for commonalities between 2020 and let's say 1988 or 89, it was a disease epidemic. The disease epidemic, in one case, it was a drug epidemic. In another case, it was a disease epidemic. But each of them resulted in very sharp social dislocations. And the economics of it are interesting also. If you think about 1987, 1988, the stock market crash, which was felt very heavily in New York, where I live, in 1987, had enormous social dislocations and economic dislocations, which sort of weakened the natural resilience of communities because fewer people were working, fewer people had those kinds of stakes in their everyday economic lives. And if you cut ahead to 2020, the economic and social dislocations from lockdowns and shutdowns and people falling ill and very high death rates is pretty much the same. So the underlying sort of health dynamic of it is somewhat different between a drug epidemic and a disease epidemic, but the effect on the body politic and the social body, was very much the same. So I don't know that 2020 is that much of an outlier in terms of the explanations, in terms of the underlying theoretical framework.
Interesting. Jeffrey Fagan there, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying crime, our guide to taking a closer look at the murder rate across the nation and in Wisconsin through time and what's happening now. You can join in at any point. Call with your question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Crime analysts, they say the murder rate in a number of large cities is declining so far this year. Milwaukee experiencing this big drop in homicides as well. And we interpret the reports, explore it in the context of history and how to address gun violence. And we have a Columbia University Law School professor, Jeffrey Fagan, as our guide. You can join in at any point. Call with your question, your voice, your comment, 800-642-1234. Jeffrey, the Washington Post reporting, there are more guns than people in our country. How much does the prevalence of guns affect our country's murder rate?
There's a lot of disagreement about that. I think the evidence tends to tilt towards saying that increase in access to guns as opposed to supply of guns, and they're correlated, but mostly access to guns, has a bigger effect. I think when the gun market, it's the legal gun market itself expands, there tends to be some spillover or leakage of firearms into the hands of folks who probably shouldn't have them. Or couldn't get them through legal channels. They may be perfectly law-abiding, safe people, but they didn't get them through legal channels. But I think it's important to keep in mind that the supply of guns in the U.S. has gone up steadily. The number of background checks, if you sort of you can chart those data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the number of background checks has been going up consistently and almost in an uninterrupted way over the past, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. Till let's say at least last 10 years. And throughout that period of increase, the homicide rate was pretty flat for a long time. And really, it really only spiked up in the last decade At the moment in early 2020, when we had were hit twice with social dislocations or social disruptions, both from political protests and also from the disease epidemic. So I think it's important to think about the portion of the legal gun market that seems to spill over into the illegal market or illegal hands, as opposed to the totality of the gun market itself.
Chief Waldner in Milwaukee's police department saying there are more lethal weapons on the streets. Is that having an impact on the homicide rate?
Well, it could. I think it has an impact on the mass shooting rate because those tend to be very high powered weapons. But every day, most murders are not mass shootings. Most murders are by handguns and interpersonal disputes. And the firepower of those has increased somewhat, but not nearly as much as it is in the higher power weapons and long guns, for example. So I don't know that we can say that. I think one way to think about that is how many people, what's the rate that we would call the case fatality rate? What is the rate of death per shooting? And we don't have great data on the number of shootings, so we really can't calculate that. We can calculate the number of firearm deaths according to data from medical examiners, but we don't know the total number of shootings. I don't get the feeling, at least in my city of New York, that the case fatality rate is changing. It's remaining, even though the total number of murders is declining, the total number of shootings is declining, the case fatality rate is remaining pretty much the same, which suggests no real difference in either the situation, the context of the conflicts that lead to these deaths, or of the firepower of the weapons that are being used.
You're having to piece together, it sounds, different statistics and bodies of information. Can you talk a little bit about primary sources of this information and the difficulty to have a clear picture and how much crime and homicides are out there in our country?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The main, of course, there's two main sources of information about shootings. One is the police. And most police departments, particularly in large cities, are very careful in recording the number of shootings, as best they know. There are some shootings that don't get into the police view because they might be treated privately, a small number. The other source is going to be medical information. And there it's an interesting dilemma. We don't really know. We know how many people die because medical examiners will issue reports and they'll make a determination that the cause of death was a firearm or gunshot wound. But we don't know the number of people with certainty who are shot and who show up in the emergency departments or admitted to the hospitals from gunshot wounds. Those data are very individual by state by state and often county by county. We get a sense of that if we look at insurance data because the hospitals all file for payment in one form or another. And so there's a national reporting system, the International Code of Disease, the ICD system, which people follow, and they code things consistently. So we can get a sense from some ICD data, from public health data, about the rate of people being admitted to either emergency rooms or to hospitals for gunshot wounds. So that's a second source. But other than that, there's not really great systematic data that covers every place. And that emergency room data is not consistent across the country. Some places, smaller states in particular, just don't report it.
Wasn't there supposed to be this big push for a national system, a national incident reporting system to provide uniformity?
There is. There's the FBI's put out and implemented the NIBRS system, it's called, National Incident-Based Reporting System. There's some problems with NIBRS being implemented consistently across the country. Not every police department and not every state has implemented NIBRS. It's a much more demanding system to fill out the NIBRS information and complete it. There's a lot of data that they want there, and it's good data. I think the design, the architecture of it is quite good, but as its predecessor, which was the uniform crime reports, getting participation by police departments is difficult. Sometimes it's just a problem of human resources, the number of people who are going to be able to fill out those forms as opposed to being on patrol or doing other duties. So it's good where it's in place. It's not in place everywhere, and it gives us a somewhat truncated or attenuated picture of particularly of firearm violence.
Jeffrey Fagan, professor at the law school at Columbia University, as we look at the homicide rate in decline this year and what to think about it. 800-642-1234. Mike in Shell Lake. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Yes.
Hi, Mike. Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
What I'd like to say, addressing gun violence, until we address how we raise our kids, teach them consequences, and show them that there are actual penalties for what they do, this isn't going to change. I mean, you have Chicago, strictest gun laws in the nation, and it just keeps on going. I mean, I've got firearms, quite a few of them, actually, and I've never come home and have them going off by themselves. There are consequences for what you do, and we don't teach anybody that anymore.
Mike, thank you. Mike, bring this back to values and teaching those consequences. Jeffrey, go ahead.
I think that's, you know, it's an important point. We don't really know as much as we could about the people who were actually doing the shooting during the period when the homicide rates were spiking up. And equally important, we don't really know about why people have set aside these kinds of options or have access to guns but aren't using them. We don't understand fully the decision-making process. And for some people, the presence of a gun is going to lead to a much greater probability that the gun will be used. For other people who do appreciate the consequences, as the caller says, the presence of a gun won't lead to its being used in a hostile or aggressive way. And I'm trying to understand the conditions that lead people to make those different kinds of decisions. Some of it is family. Some of it is temperament and personality. Some of it is context, where you feel that you have no choice but to use a gun because the other person may have a gun. The caller is right in for some portion of the population, but I think the broader picture is that two things. One, the presence of a gun actually sort of changes the way people make decisions, even if they don't want to, because it's either me or you if you feel that the other person is armed.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us. Jeffrey Fagan, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying policing, crime, guns, and race. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.